Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? You good? Are you keeping well and safe, doing what you need to do from day to day? Whether that's, you know, being stuck in the kitchen baking your banana bread, or doing what I've been doing this week, which is homeschooling. Crikey. Let's just say that helping an 8.5-year-old with the maths is not my strong point, I'll be honest. So a huge respect to all the teachers out there. Yeah, that's hard graft, to tell you. So if you are homeschooling, and it's a bit of a shock to the system, isn't it? But I hope you're having fun whilst you're doing it. I'm getting to grips with it a little bit more as the days go on. So what is going on? I'll tell you what's going on. Last week, I got together and had a fantastic conversation, which is this episode 124. Now, if you have seen Detectorists, the brilliant comedy that was on BBC Four with Mackenzie Crook and Toby Jones and Rebecca Callard, or you've seen King Gary with Tom Davis on BBC One, then you will know Laura Checkley. Well, you'll certainly know her acting style, but will you know her? Well, you will get to know it in a bit, because we had a fantastic conversation last week, and it goes everywhere. We talk about childhood, school, sexuality, being honest and true to yourself. And, you know, I've said this before, it's always a bit of a roll of the dice when you get guests on and you've never met before and you're not even meeting now. You're just having a conversation and you hit record and you go for it. And we really did. And it was like sitting down and catching up with a very dear friend. It was lovely, lovely conversation. I really cannot wait for you to hear it. So let's stop messing about. Let's get down to it. This is episode 124 of the Two Shot Podcast with the fantastic Laura Checkley. Enjoy. I shall see you at the end. Kind of.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Yeah, it's funny because I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, actually, and we were on the phone and I was saying, I'm just not a fan. I've never been a fan of the FaceTime and the video calls, full stop.
No, it's a funny old concept, and I know it's a great way for us to keep in touch at the moment, but I just find it a bit exhausting. I'd rather just have a chat old styley on the phone.
Yeah. Me too. I mean, of course we're such social animals and we're craving that interaction right now. I understand that, but it's so synthetic for me.
Yeah.
In a way I find it frustrating, you know?
Yeah. Listen, it's nice to see the nieces and nephews. They don't want to know anyway. And half the time they're running around the phone, so you're looking at a ceiling, you know, getting vertigo.
Of course.
But yeah, I think it's nice for... I just find like it's like a kid's thing. They all love it, don't they? There's Snapchat. I mean, I've got loads of nieces and nephews. I've got loads, but you know, I've got a few. And they're always recording themselves. And they're really comfortable with that. I feel a bit cringy when I put something up on Instagram. I feel like it's just, I'm not really good on the phone anyway. my mates will tell you, I'd just rather go and meet you for a coffee or sit down at a pub. I just, yeah, I find the whole concept weird, and I'm not good on the phone anyway.
Well, soon we'll have all that, Laura. We'll have it back. No. I'm so pleased that you've decided to come on.
Well, thanks for having me. I was actually chuffed when you messaged me. I thought, has he got the right person? And I told my girlfriend, I was like, oh, yeah, I've been asked this podcast. And she was like, that podcast? Are you joking? Why do they want to talk to you? I said, I don't know.
Because I think you're interesting. I think we'll have a good conversation.
Well,
usually that's what I do, is it? As I meet people, we have a cup of tea or we get some cake if we're in London at my friend's.
I'd have loved that.
But a lot of people would. I remember when I met up with Mark Strong last year and he went, why aren't we in Maison Berthault having tea and cake? I said, sorry, Mark, you know, sorry to disappoint you. So what I've done, we're going to sort of slightly restructure it. Let me just get my notes. Sometimes I finish the episodes with this and sometimes I start it. So what I thought I'd do as a little icebreaker was do a little lightning round with you.
Oh, crikey, all right.
Oh, do you think?
Yeah, go on, yeah.
All right.
What is it?
Positivity is the way, Laura. So I'm going to give you, it's like an either or situation.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Right. And you just have to just tell us and then we'll get a bit, you know, we'll know a bit more about your tastes and then we'll get to know a bit more about you after that.
Okay. Yeah, go on.
So should we dive
in? Yeah, go on. Yeah, let's do it.
Here we go. Starter or dessert?
Oh, starter, all the way.
Vinyl or download?
Vinyl.
Yes or no?
I want to be a yes person, but I can often be a no.
That's interesting. We'll get to that later. Yeah. Saturday night or Sunday morning?
Saturday night.
Town or country?
In what respect? Oh, I just answer, shouldn't I? Town.
Train or plane?
Train.
Lennon or McCartney?
Ooh, Lennon.
Beatles or Stones?
Beatles.
North or South?
South.
Easy. We'll get to that later. Home or away?
Home.
Answer the phone or leave to voicemail?
Leave to voicemail. Isn't it dreadful? Yes.
You're not the first one. You won't be the last. A long bath or a quick shower?
Oh, long bath.
Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Passenger or driver?
Passenger.
Winter or summer?
Winter.
Weekday or weekend?
Weekend.
Christmas Eve or Christmas Day?
Christmas Eve, always.
To give or to receive?
To give.
Detectorist or King Go?
Oh, you arsehole. That's not fair.
I know, that's a tricky one.
Even me, yeah, I just called you an arsehole in the first 5 minutes. It would have to be King Gary, unfortunately. I like detectives.
Oh, there we go. You've called it now, Laura.
I know.
So, Laura, I'm here in my studio and in Gloucestershire. And when I say studio, I mean I've got my laptop on the chest of drawers and I've got pillows surrounding me.
But it sounds really good to say studio. Because you've got
a
podcast, you need
studio.
To sound professional, don't you?
Yeah, and many things I don't know how professional I am. Where are you? Where are we speaking to you from?
I'm in Crystal Palace in a flat I've not long bought, actually. And I'm in my bedroom because it's carpeted everywhere else. It's sort of wooden floors and a bit echoey. And I've still not got enough furniture in it. So it's still a little, so I'm trying to give you as good sound quality as I can.
It's sounding pucker.
Lovely.
Now, are you from Crystal Palace originally?
No, I'm from Hounslow. Sorry, I'm just having to drink water. I'm from Hounslow, West London. Like all my family hail from Shepherd's Bush area.
Right.
But I grew up in Hounslow and then I sort of moved south after drama school. I think we just got a cheap deal somewhere. Like, I think we went Canada Water to begin with. Just because we got a good deal. I don't know why we went there, really. I liked it.
Tell me about growing up in Hounslow. Is that you? Are you and you, what? You've got siblings?
Yeah, I've got a brother and I've got two stepsisters. But my stepsisters lived with their mum. So it was me and my brother and my mum and stepdad. And yeah, grew up in Hounslow. Sort of, I actually was born in Ascot in Bracknell. And then we moved when I was like five or six. I don't really remember Bracknell, sort of have flashes of it. And then, yeah, and then was in Hounslow right up through till when I sort of went off to drama school, really. We had just towards the end of my time living with mum and dad, it was my stepdad, they moved to Chiswick. They did a bit better and moved to Chiswick. So I spent a little bit of time in Chiswick, but unfortunately by that point, Hounslow had its full effect. Hounslow's a funny old place for anyone that's ever grown up in it. It's a bit transient, you know, like it always feels like everyone's passing through to get to Heathrow.
Right.
And it's a bit of a forgotten town, as was my school. It was always the school, and I think if I'm right in saying my school is still like bottom of the league, and it was a rough old, yeah, it was a rough old school really. And it,
how was school for you?
I played football really a lot, Craig, so I kept out of trouble.
You just threw yourself into sports.
Yeah, I was really good at football, and I played for Brentford when I was a kid, and I had loads of promise, but I was sort of going to this dance school at the same time. I had like these two lives growing up, really. I went to this really posh dance school that a mate down my road had gone, oh, there's this dance school around the corner, do you want to go? And she ended up sort of going for a couple of weeks, and she couldn't bear it, so she left, and I sort of stayed because I thought, oh, I quite like this. But they were really posh, so I'd sort of be there trying to be someone I wasn't. And then at school as well, like I had my football, but I sort of felt like I didn't really belong there either. Like, I got through school by being really good at sports and just playing with the lads in the playground, really. Playground.
When you say you didn't feel like you belonged at school, what do you mean by that? Did you have a good group of friends, or were you a bit of a loner and just football?
I was a floater. I think, you know, I was all. I think how I got through school, like you look at a girl the wrong way in the school I went to, and that was it. You're in a fight. And my brother went there, so I sort of had a bit of protection in that first year when I arrived, and it was terrifying, this school that I went to. But my mum sent me because my brother went there, and I didn't really want to go there. But, you know, I think now we're really choosy, aren't we, about schools? I haven't got kids, but I know mates that are really, like, they move areas so they can get in that catchment area for that particular school. And I just don't think when we were growing up, that was it. You just went to the nearest school so you'd be safe walking home. That was the case for us anyway, as a working class family. My mum just sent me to a school that my brother was at, and I was all right. I was okay. But I think if I'd have been at a better school, I would have been a bit more academically driven. I kept my head down at school, and I had my brother there for the first year. But I felt like, especially when I started going to the dance school, I felt like there was something cool in me, and I didn't know what it was. And I was hanging out with all these posh people that went to really private schools or went to stage schools. And I sort of wanted to be part of that world, but didn't feel good enough, because I think if you are inherently working class, I always think when you're around posh people, you always feel a little bit like I always feel like I'm on guard, sort of trying to bat back as quickly as I can. And that's probably my own shit. But like, as a working class kid, and then being around all those people, seeing another side to that life, and not just the performing side, it was more to do with money and seeing their houses, you know, going, oh, fucking hell, this is nicer than my house. My mum kept a beautiful home, beautiful, you know, like you sit down and you're frightened you'd ruin all her scatter cushions. But yeah, I'd go to school and I'd have this, I didn't really tell anyone I went dancing because people would be jealous. And so I just kept, no one really knew me that well at school. And also I was also struggling with sexuality as well, so all of that sort of was going on. So, yeah, when you grow up working class kid in Hounslow, it's a bit of ducking and diving, really. I felt like I survived school, not sort of enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, you just sort of navigate your way through sometimes, don't you? And it's interesting what you say, that you're a floater, that you sort of, you don't belong to any sort of peer group, but you sort of, you know, you do what you do. You float between a lot of them. To survive.
Yeah, I remember I had to look after this girl that had come over from Nigeria, and she didn't speak a lot of English, and the teacher gave her to my friend Amanda and me. I was always really good mates with Amanda. And we looked after this girl called Ronke, and it was sort of like our second or third year. I think she gave her to us because we were nice and we showed her around and, you know, we stuck up for her and people being horrible to her because she didn't, her language was really limited. And yeah, we just became really good friends with her. And it turns out she really, really hard faced cow and she was really hard. So no one touched us because we hung out with Ronke and Ronke always had our back because we looked after her from the beginning. So yeah, we had protection by the end. I had a bit of a girl group by the end, by the time I hit sort of puberty. You know, but my first 4 years at school was all about just get out, play football and sort of keep the girls happy and not come in for me. As long as no one was coming for you, you just, that's it, you carried on. Funny, isn't it? I haven't thought about school for ages.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, when we go back and we regress and we think about school life and what we were like then and you go, oh God, that's such a different lifetime. It's a different person to who...
You couldn't pay me to go back to school, that's for sure. I look at my niece, I have so many conversations with her. She's 15, bless her, and she just hates school, and I get it. I just totally get it. It's so hard for some kids, you know. And then some kids have a great time, don't they? Best years of their life, you know.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, but to be honest, you know, I mean, my little boy's nearly nine, and he really loves school. He doesn't necessarily love the work, but he certainly loves the social.
But he's at primary school, isn't he? I quite liked my primary school.
Did you know?
Yeah.
Where was that?
It was lovely. I had a great teacher.
Which is key.
Yes, yeah. And I remember, I never forget, I've got this really vivid memory of one of the other teachers running in and saying, she's gone. And it was when Thatcher had gone. And I remember my teacher punching the air. And it was the first time I thought, oh, is she really bad then, Margaret Thatcher? Because like, I didn't engage in politics at that age, not really. And then I remember always thinking, oh, there's something really great about this woman. She's really liberal. Anyway, it turns out years later, obviously she's gay. And obviously as a young girl who didn't know at all about sexuality then, I think I was looking up to her and I didn't know at the time why, but now looking back in hindsight, obviously something in my instinct told me I was a little like her maybe, but she was wonderful, really brilliant. And I had a really great education in those first years. It's when I moved to senior school that it all got horrible, really.
Do you remember a significant moment when you were coming to terms with your sexuality?
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Because you think... Because I've always sort of really liked boys' company. Obviously, I played football with them and I was always their mate. So I was sort of like the perfect girlfriend growing up. I remember it was at senior school, actually. When I was younger, I didn't think about it much. I remember being intrigued by certain women, but they wasn't much older. And I just thought, oh, it's because I want to be like them or I really admired them. And I think that's how it starts. It starts there and looking back. And I remember I was in my, probably like, I was like 14. And I remember this TIE group came into my, it was when I was at senior school. And they performed, and I really loved my drama, obviously, and I was obsessed with drama. And so, yeah, this TIE group come in. I remember this actress, and just, yeah, I'd like find out all her timetable and hang outside her room, you know, when she had a break, and I'd just to say, hi, miss, you know. And I remember looking back now, that was the point. I just thought, I want to be like her because she's an actress. But I think looking back now and all the feelings that were stirring, you know, it was definitely a part. I think it sort of saying, yes, you are gay. I think you're gay. But I ignored it for years. That's another tricky thing, being a very working class person and being gay, you know. It's a tricky one to manoeuvre when you grow up in a place where no one's even met a gay guy, let alone a lesbian, you know. So, but I think that was it. It was around about 13, 14 that I thought, oh, no. And I always wanted to, I always got really obsessed with any TV programme that had any sort of gay storyline. Do you remember Brookside with Anna Frail?
Well, of course,
that
huge that was such landmark television, that moment, wasn't
and
it?
And watching that, I mean, everyone was obviously hooked, weren't they, by that, and that whole storyline. And it was, wasn't it like the first ever lesbian kiss aired or something? God, we're going back now, aren't we?
I mean, I think it certainly was, you know, most definitely on a... pre-Watershed soap opera.
Yeah.
Definitely. Because, but remember the when Jeanette Winterson her book Orange Is Not the Only Fruit mm-hmm. was adapted for telly, and it was like, oh,
yeah,
I was just, you know, shock all around that this was happening. But this was like, you know, that was you know, 9 o'clock drama, yeah. BBC Two.
And I think obviously as well with soaps being so accessible, and you know, and your Uncle Dave's watching it, and it will, you know, might not necessarily tune in to watch, you know, Orange Isn't the Only Fruit, but it's like, yeah, I remember that moment very vividly, and not just going, oh wow, you know, oh what a, you know, shocking, two women kissing. I remember like wanting to rewind it, watch it again, and rewind it and watch it again, and where I could, you know, I'd try and like watch the omnibus so I could watch it again. And yeah.
And did you know at that time? Yeah, that's
no.
That's
I just who... I think looking back, yes, of course, but I think I was just confused. I was like, oh, I don't know, but I still sort of quite fancy that boy over there. And you know, I think I wasn't a forward girl in terms of my sexuality. Like, I was still climbing trees at 14. I didn't wear mascara, and you know, I didn't really explore all of that. So I think because it came to me a bit later, it took a while to sort of figure it all out. And you know, I had boyfriends. I always had boyfriends. It's quite, yeah, but they didn't ever last very long. Remember when I came out, my mum said, you know, I think we always knew, because you could never hold down a boyfriend, because it would just get to the point where, you know, they wanted more, and I just was like, oh no, we're just mates, aren't we?
So
it was like it took a long time. And actually, it wasn't, my family were wonderful when I came out, thank God. It was actually, you know, more my own struggle that stopped me, not anyone else's, really.
Your own struggle, when you say what, it, as in terms of, you know, a long period of repression or a long period of figuring out exactly who you are, or being honest with yourself before you can be honest with anybody else?
Yeah, I think it was being honest with myself and then being terrified of losing everyone. I think that's what stops a lot of people from coming out, the being terrified of losing your, you know, your parents and, you know, friends you don't worry about so much. I mean, when I was obviously coming out a bit younger, I was worried about some of my girlfriends, and a couple of them said, oh, did you ever fancy me growing up? And, you know, the answer was always no. But yeah, I think it was, I didn't want to be gay. That was it. I didn't want to be gay. And I'm sure along the way that is conditioning, for sure. Not anyone's fault. You know, your parents are doing the best job they know how. But when,
yeah, of course.
But my family didn't mix with liberal types. You know, I grew up in, you know, my stepdad was in the army, military man, and my mum was a working class woman who didn't rock the boat, you know, always voted for the same party because that's what they do. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't, I think it's conditioning, but I was never sort of, you know, never, my family were never sort of, you know, talking down about gay people. It just wasn't talked about. No one knew a gay person, and that was that.
And also, they're of a different generation.
Of course. You know, it's...
I remember years ago, and this is no disrespect to my mum, and I love her very dearly, and she's an amazing woman. But I remember when she used to find out that certain people on telly who she really loved were gay. And she'd go, oh, but I found out they were gay. Like she felt really sorry for them.
Yeah, they
were gay.
Well, my mum would say, oh, now I've just found out he's gay. What a shame. What a waste, you know.
What a waste. But, like, they don't mean anything by it. It's not, it's, I mean.
It's just what they know, isn't it?
And it's just what they know. Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. Now, you know, with the way the world is and where we are.
Oh, God,
things,
yeah.
Things are slowly changing, I think.
I think. My family particularly now, you know, it's like, it's just not even thought about. It just doesn't even register. You know, I still go to family parties and someone will tell me a gay joke thinking it's funny, and it doesn't matter because it's about gay men and not women. And I just sort of have to gently remind them that, you know, you're telling that to a gay person, by the way. It's still quite insulting. Oh, you're different though, aren't you? You're different though, aren't you? Get all of that. Not from my immediate family. My parents have been wonderful, particularly actually my stepdad was amazing. And I actually thought he'd find it the hardest because being a military man, you know, really disciplined sort of upbringing. And actually he was really, really wonderful. And it's actually my mum struggled a bit more than him. And I think had he not been so brilliant about it, I think she may have struggled more. But it takes time when you come out. And I think, you know, do you know what bothers me now when people say things like, oh, I mean, he's gay, come on. I mean, why doesn't he just come out? It's 2020. And it's like, because they might not be ready. It's their struggle. And I'm not down with that. People going, oh, come out, it's fine. It's like, until you're struggling with that and you understand that journey, it's not easy. Even if your family are brilliant and liberal and da-da-da, it's your own struggle. Yeah. It's how you feel about it. And back then, and you know, if you'd have given me a pill to be straight, I probably would have done, because back then I would have thought life will be easier if I'm not gay. And that was that, you know. Don't, of course, think that now.
And what came to a head, Laura, that you felt that, no, I have to not only be honest with myself, but certainly be honest with the people I love? Was any sort of repression making you unhappy?
Yeah, I was very unhappy, and I always felt, you know, like there was... the only way I can ever explain it is when I came out, I woke up, and for the first time in my life, and I came out at 23, that I didn't have a burden on my shoulder. It felt like a burden, a secret, a dirty secret. And I'd never really done anything about my sexuality. I always knew it along the way. It took me falling in love to tell them and to come out. And because I felt like it would be taken seriously, if I meet someone and fall in love with them, then I'll come out, because then they'll have to take it seriously. And I think, yeah, that's how I came out, really. I fell in love. But I pretended throughout the whole of my 3 years at drama school to be straight, until, you know, a girl in my year, we just, by the end of our 3 years, just don't know why, we ended up working together and we just fell in love. And that was that, you know. But it was just so exhausting pretending all the time. I used to do this thing where I'd go, I haven't had a boyfriend about 6 months, just so no one, you know, thinks anything or starts chatting. I'll just go out with him over there on the acting course. He's all right. Do you know what I mean? I used to do things like that all the time. Dreadful. Just so that no one would suspect or think, you know, why has Laura not had a boyfriend in a while? Dreadful, isn't it, really?
But the thing is, I mean, you know, you say dreadful. I don't know. I mean, it's very natural, because if you're dragging around dishonesty, it becomes heavier and heavier.
Of course, because all those people that you get close to, you think, well, they're just going to think I've been lying to them. And
yeah. And you know, you spin off in a cycle of worry, and then you start to get lost. And it's whatever it is, whether it's about your sexuality or it's about the predicament that you're in as a human being, whatever that may be, it's a heavy, heavy weight, and it's a huge burden. Mm. And sometimes you feel so lost that there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, it feels like, I suppose it's like, you know, you just so far down in that hole, you think, oh, it's just easier not to. And I just always felt like it's just easier not to rock the boat. Grew up in a household where, you know, my sisters had quite volatile relationships. And I always felt like the child that didn't bring any problems. And then when I was gay, I thought, oh, but now I'm bringing another problem. My parents have, you know, really had it over the years, you know, dealing with everyone's issues, all my, you know, my sisters and my brother, and just lots of things along the way. I thought, I'm the only one who hasn't brought many problems. And I saw it as a problem. So I thought it's easier for me to live with this burden than to give it to anyone else. And yeah.
See, that's so interesting when you say it, that that it manifested itself to you as a problem.
Yeah. And like, oh, absolutely. It's exactly what it was.
And then were you feeling like huge guilt that if you said this, then you're going to be laying this at somebody else's doorstep?
Yeah. You haven't really thought about that before, but yeah. Yeah, I think I absolutely did feel like that, particularly when my parents were involved. Friends were different. You just didn't want them to think you hadn't been honest with them or shown who you really are. And that's the truth. When you come out, you go, I'm exactly the same. You just didn't know this bit about me.
Yeah.
It doesn't define you. And I know we all know that now, but back then it felt like it really defined one, you know.
And who, did you, was it like your mum and your stepdad that you came out to first, or was it? Or did you ease yourself in with a close friend?
We eased ourselves. We were both obviously coming out, so we both eased in with our drama school mates, who were obviously amazing, and they sort of right. all knew anyway because we were hanging out all the time. I don't know who we thought we well, were fooling.
I was gonna say, did you have anybody that went, yeah, I've got, well. Yeah, of course.
They were like, babe, we've known for ages. Crazy. You know, we're just waiting yeah. for you to tell us. So that was an easy thing. And I remember because my first girlfriend is, she's married now to a man and got kids. And I was actually only her only ever girlfriend. So at the time, coming out for me, I was like, I remember being really upset. I cried a lot, just the relief of telling somebody. She was actually quite strong. And the truth was, is because I'd been struggling my whole life with my sexuality, she hadn't. So for her, she'd just fallen in love with the person and that was that. But I remember yeah. all my friends going, but you were so much more upset. You were just, you didn't stop crying. And I said, oh, I was just relieved. I've been holding this in for so long. But it's interesting to look at the two reactions of someone who was just fallen in love with someone else that hadn't struggled with their sexuality really, to somebody that's been hiding it for so long, and the relief that I felt with that. But telling my parents was the next level. It was, yeah, it was, God, I'll never forget that night. I actually came out to them. We were in the summer house at the bottom of our garden, and we were watching Will and Grace. That's not even a joke. Like, I hadn't even thought about it because it was my mum that pointed, because I had come out. We just sat there for ages being quiet once I'd cried. And my mum said, oh, the irony, we're watching Will and Grace, you know. But yeah, I actually didn't say the words, I'm gay. I got really upset, and my dad said, what is it? My mum asked all the questions, are you pregnant? Are you in debt? I go, no, I just couldn't get it out. I couldn't say the yeah. words. And my dad turned around and said, are you gay, love? And I just went, oh, yeah. And then that was that. And he said, we've known for some time. So I thought, oh, fucking hell, right. You think, I think mostly your parents know, I just do. I think, how can they not? I think mostly they know. Even if they think they don't know, I think instinct tells them. It took a while, and then once you sort of introduce the girlfriend for the first time, and it's sort of done then, and everyone's like, oh, it's all right, and everyone's normal, and it's fine.
Because we're just human beings and we just fall in love with who we fall in love with, and that's it.
That's it, right? So,
yeah, well, yeah, I like to think so.
Yeah, I didn't think I'd talk about my coming out tale.
No, I mean, look, as ever with these podcasts and these conversations, it's as organic as possible. Conversation between two people. That's what I always wanted.
Yes, what I love when I listen back to your other, you know, I've listened to lots of people, and I love that about that, because that's life, isn't it? We go off on different tangents, different directions.
Well, exactly. And, you know, we're forever veering off road all the time, and that's what we do. That scattergun approach to conversations I love, because sometimes, especially me, I mean, I know I don't do the lion's share of the talking on these podcasts, but you know, I'm accused a lot of the time by my, you know, my brain not connecting with my mouth, because I've got so many thoughts. It's just sort of...
Oh, I feel like that all the time. I just think you've overshared there, just, Laura. What have you done?
it blurts out of my mouth without thinking. But, Laura, I want to jump back now to the end of school. And we know that drama was playing a large part of school, but also football was as well. So what was the next step for you?
So I'd heard about this place called the Brit School, and I didn't want to do my A-levels. Well, I did, but I only wanted to do English. I wasn't interested in it. I wasn't hugely academic. I'm terrible at maths, like shocking. I'd never forget my exam, my GCSE exam, like cold sweat, really bad. And science, equally, I think I got like a double E for science or something like that. Really bad, but really good at French, art and drama and English. So I knew I sort of wanted to do an English A-level, but I didn't want to stay in Hounslow. I was like, as soon as I could get the hell out of that school, I wanted to. And I'd heard about this place called the Brit School. I'd been going to this like amateur dramatics place. and someone had told me about it. And I knew it was free because it's the only non-fee paying performing arts college in the UK, I believe, still. So I knew that money wouldn't be an issue. And I always had, as soon as I heard that there was such a thing called drama school, I always had that ahead of me. But I didn't know I was going to do it, but I thought that's how I do it, because all those posh girls at my school, at the dance place, that's what they did, that's what they've done, and that's how you become an actor. So,
and was this something at the time that you thought, I think that's for me, or were you still sort of playing around?
I think I felt torn about football and acting up until I was about 14. So basically I used to play for Brentford, like they're called Junior Bees, and then I started playing for this a team called District Line, strangely. I don't know why, it was somewhere along the District Line. And right. And my dad, my biological dad, he started coaching. So he used to be like a Sunday league referee. And he got me involved in this team. And a girl from my school, actually, Louise, who from Hounslow, we both played for Brentford. I think someone must have come and scouted us. I can't remember how I got to Brentford. I remember it being through a PE teacher at school, because he used to scout boys for Chelsea and stuff, but he was also like a PE teacher. Don't ask me. That's right. Sort of what I remember. So I was always, I knew I was a talented footballer, and I got, when I was playing for District Line, we were in like semi-finals of some tournament and got scouted by Arsenal and got offered a trial at 14 for Arsenal. But really weirdly, and I had my mum had said, look, everything's starting to clash, you need to make a decision. And I don't think I did need to make a decision. It's like, love my mum dearly, but I feel like subconsciously there was something in my mum going, don't let her do football. Because I think it might have had a play on my sexuality. I don't know. I don't think subconsciously she did this, and she probably like, I did not. But she said to me, just remember, there's no money in women's football. Like, I'm just worried about you going down this route, and you're really talented and you can sing and dance and act. Like, I don't know why you wouldn't pursue that.
Is she aware? Was she not aware of the precarious nature of becoming an actor?
Clearly not, so mate. I mean,
there's no money in women's football.
I know, right? Can you bear it? I know. I mean, now obviously you can earn pretty good money.
Well, you know, only a few weeks ago. Well, the last podcast we recorded one to one post all this was with Karen Bardsley.
Oh my God! Amazing.
Yeah. Up in Manchester. Oh, amazing. It was just fantastic talk.
I bet. Oh, I'll have to have a listen to that. I had a manager, because at this point I weren't playing with my dad. There was another guy. I can't remember his name. That really upsets me. I can never remember his name. The guy that I remember him calling my mum, and we were on the downstairs phone, and she called me and she said, I think his name was Paul or something. I can't remember. And anyway, he got on the phone and he said, what's this about you not going to go to this trial for Arsenal? And I just said, I just, everything's clashing and my mum's saying I can't do both. And he's like, you're mad, you could play for England. And I just said, well, it's what I've decided. And that was that. And that was when I walked away from football. And I'll always think back to that and think, oh, I wonder what would have happened if I'd have just gone. Sliding doors, right?
Do you, when you say that, do you think about it, or
occasionally,
is it a regret? Those two are very—they're very different, aren't they?
I don't regret, because, as it turns out, I do think I was meant to be an actor, and I think because when I played football, I was a striker, because I loved scoring, I loved showing off, and that was part of being a striker. But I was a bit prissy on the field. I didn't like to tackle, And I've got a dicky knee, so I reckon I'd have definitely been injury bound. Right. So all of those things play in my mind, but I think that's me excusing and sort of going, well, that's why you made the decision, Lauren. It was absolutely right to make that decision. I do think there's always part of me, though, that thinks, I wonder what if I'd have gone to that trial? Yeah. Who knows?
Do you still play now at all?
I'll have a little kick about if there's a football floating around. When we were on the set of King Gary, the boys were all playing at lunch and whatever, and they were trying to get me over there, but obviously I'm not stupid and I didn't want to get injured. So, because they were really going for it, the crew, I think they were hacking off everyone's legs. It was terrible. They were really going for it, so I didn't get involved, but I had a little kick about, you know, and a few keepy-uppies, and do miss it though. I've always flirted with the idea of maybe going to do a little Sunday league somewhere, but you know what it's like when you're an actor and you think, I don't want to like let anyone down and go, sorry, I can't come to that on the Wednesday when you know, practicing. I was about to say rehearsing then, practicing. And you just, yeah, I think if you're going to join a team, you've got to be able to commit to a Wednesday evening practice, haven't you, in a Sunday, you know, Sunday match. And we can't always do that, can we? So,
of course. And also, you know, you don't want to be mid filming something and then you have an injury and you break a leg,
of course,
or you break an arm or something,
of course.
And
then, but I love a kick. If there's a ball, I want to kick it for sure.
So it's always going to still there in you, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's I love it, and I love watching football. And you know, I'm a Liverpool fan. I didn't know if you know that. Did you know that?
I didn't know that, Laura. You know that I know nothing about football.
Do you not?
No, I'm like I.
Why should you? Why should you?
Well, though? It's just, you know, it's just like, oh well, boys like football. I don't really. I just never really been into it at all. I just can't get it at all. I appreciate it,
yeah,
and I understand people's love for it,
yeah,
and I respect it, but for me now it's just never clicked.
Well, yeah, I get that. Like, I've never really been into rugby or cricket, so yeah, and I love my sports, you know. I love my sport, but my brother's a big really great at golf, my brother, but you know, he couldn't ever pursue that because we didn't have the money. So you have to, rich man's game, golf, and
absolutely,
he was super talented as well. It's really gutting because I know he could have been amazing, but yeah, we just didn't have enough money to keep him going. It's unreal the money you've got to put into golf, but yeah, it's a shame he weren't good at football, really, because it costs now to kick a ball about, does it?
No, exactly. And what a great education for some kids, you know.
Yeah. That's all we did on my street. We went out and played football. And that's how I got good. I played the boys right from a young age.
Sometimes that's what the summer holidays were.
Yeah, wasn't it?
Kicked out and you go off with your mates and you do what you do. And if you're in the football leagues with the kids, then that's what you do all day. And then you come home sweaty as hell at 5:30 and you want your sandwiches and then you go back out for a couple of hours.
Yeah. Do you know what? If I ever walk past some, like certain fields or whatever, and there's like a kids match going on, you know, like under sevens or under 12s or whatever, you see a local football match with the kids, I always stop and watch, and I love it. Just any bit of football, you know, just love that. And it really takes me back, you know, that coming back red-faced, gasping for a orange squash and your dinner and, you know, grass stains all over your knees. And yeah, that's what I love to look back on in my childhood, as opposed to school's kind of, I've blocked it out really, school.
Well, I say keep the happy memories alive,
yeah,
and bin off the ones that are not helpful.
Yeah. So, I mean, oh God, I've gone off on a tangent, haven't I? But what were we talking about? Yeah, so I went to Brit School.
So you did go there?
Yeah, I did, yeah. You had to audition for it. So yeah. I turned up, did an audition. I think I had to sing a bit of a song and do a bit of a speech, which I think, I don't know, someone would give me an amdram. Yeah, and then I went there for 2 years, and I started doing art A-level and English A-level and then a B-tech in performing arts, and you get an A-level in performing arts. And I sat in English for two lessons and I thought, oh, fuck this. I want to go over there and do some extra dance and singing. And yes, I stopped doing the A-level art and English. I mean, can you bear it? Wish I'd done it. Yeah. Yeah, my mum went mad, but I didn't want to do it.
So you were allowed to... Sorry, this was all at the Brit School,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So you were allowed to cease carrying on with that side of that education?
Well, yeah, because you're only going there for the A-level, so you can just go there and do the B-tech in performing arts and A-level art, A-level
right.
In performing arts, whatever they called it. But then the other A-levels on top would be considered extra and up to you. So dropping it,
okay.
I remember it not being an issue. I think I walked out and went, I don't want to do it anymore.
And how old were you at this point, Laura?
So A-level years, it's like 16 to 18 at the Brit School.
Okay.
And that was great, you know, load of working class kids that were just sort of talented and didn't know what to do with it. It's a great place, Brit School. Still, you know, still going, and it's in Croydon. First taste of Croydon.
Did you feel a real sense of community there?
Yeah. Yeah. First time I thought, oh, this is it, I've arrived. Because you know what it's like with even being an actor, you know, just working with different age groups. And, you know, I've got mates, I don't really, I have a few mates my own age, but I've got loads of mates in their 50s, and I've got some mates that are in their 20s that I've worked with. Like, that's what I love about our industry. It's like...
Yeah, it is incredible, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you just don't feel limited in who you could meet or who you could mix with. And I think back when I was younger, I thought I would probably never have a posh mate. I've got loads of posh mates now, obviously. Yeah. And also you just get a bit older, don't you? You just think, oh, fuck it, it's who I am. You like me or you don't, you know.
So was it a happy time
yeah.
for 2 years once you'd made that decision to go, right, I'm cutting that out of my life and I'm going to focus on this?
Yeah, it was absolutely, yeah. I felt like I'd arrived, yeah, like I said. And yeah, and then, I mean, they're brilliant. They took you and they just got you ready for drama school, basically. And then... they sort of said, here, have a look at this place, that might suit you. And off I trotted. And then I didn't get in the first year because, I don't know, just didn't get in the first year. But I only went for like one college. I don't know why. Went for like GSA because I used to do musicals. I don't know if you know that.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, but I ended up going to Mountview and I did a 3-year musical theatre course there.
Do you know that's where I went?
Well, I heard on your podcast, I think when you were talking to Sophie, yeah. I think you said you went to
it. It does come up. Yeah, yeah, of course. Wow, I didn't know that, Laura.
Yeah, because I thought, oh, do I know you? Did we go at the same time? But you must have been there just a bit before me. But yeah, but I wanted to act, you see, really. But I got a scholarship there and I didn't get a scholarship for... I got really close for RADA. That's really where I wanted to go, but it didn't work out. And at the end, they said to me, because you have to sing at a RADA audition. Well, I did anyway. And they went, oh, you've got a very good voice. Why don't you go and do a musical theatre course? So I thought, oh, all right. And then I got offered a scholarship at Mountview. So I just went where the scholarship was, really, because my mum and... Dad didn't have money, no one, not even close, you know.
No, of course not. And we know, we all know, especially when I'm talking to actors on this podcast, how expensive that is. And it just, everything just hemorrhages money.
It's, yeah, and unfortunately, I mean, when I went, I think we had a Labour government. So, I mean, they were calling them dance and drama awards, that the amount of scholarships floating about was unreal. It was fantastic. Yeah. So I went just at the right time. But I think now, like, imagine now trying to get in, like, it's elitist and again, and yeah, you can't go to drama school unless you've got some money now, or unless you're super lucky and you get one or two of the scholarships that are floating about for that year. It's really sad, really.
It is. It's a real shame that... education is blocked.
Yeah.
For certain people.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's something I feel quite passionate about, really, and I just, because there's, you know, having been there myself, and I saw, you know, lots of my Brit schoolmates ended up sort of having kids and not really doing it, but they all had a shot at it, at least, and that's the thing.
And that's all we can ask for, is, you know, that people deserve a shot. But the great thing is now, I think, that the drama school route isn't the only path. It isn't the only avenue.
Not now, of course, with online and socials and all that. Yeah, of course.
And also the certain casting directors, especially people like Shaheen Baig and Des Hamilton, who, you know, get out of the office and go look for new talent, and whether it's, you know, Oldham Theatre Workshop, Nottingham,
yeah,
you know, wherever it is. They'll go and hunt it down.
Yeah, and I you're absolutely right. And I've seen loads of Shaheen. She's fantastic, like, looking for new, exciting talent, and especially for TV as well. You don't need to have, you know, trodden the boards and done your check-off and your whatever. You just need to be real and tell the truth and be able to locate that. And I just think that I wish more casting directors would do that. I mean, I know, like, just myself being working class and being in the comedy circuit and how difficult it was to be that person. And, like, you know, I go on and on about
my class because I feel quite passionate about it. And it took me a while to get going because obviously I started in musical theatre. So it took me a massive while. It took me a long chunk of my time to make the leap over to acting because who wants to know when you're a twirly, you know? Like what I wanted to be doing was comedy and I didn't know how to do that at all. So I went on the comedy circuit because someone had said to me once, you know, if you want to do comedy, get on the comedy circuit. So that's what I did.
As in what, Laura? Stand-up?
I was in a double act called Checkley and Bush. And we did about 3 Edinburghs. And, yeah, it was enough to... We were around for about 5 years, but we only did 3 Edinburghs because we never had the money. And it's so expensive to go to Edinburgh if you want to do it right. Yeah. You know, people go, oh, just go up there, you know, do the Free Fringe and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, but I've got to have the money to take that month off work, pay for me accommodation and my food, pay for leaflets and posters. And, you know, the list is endless. Even if you're doing the Free Fringe, you've got to have a bit of money. And my mum didn't have it. My comedy partner's parents didn't have it and certainly wouldn't give it to us. So we...
And also it's very rare to be going up to Edinburgh and walking out with a bit of spare change in your pocket. I mean, you're going to be losing money.
100%, yeah. And we were clever about, we raised money. We put on a big shindig one night with all our family and friends, charged them some ticket money, invited loads of our comedy mates and singers. And we raised some money and wrote lots of letters. And we got there just by, you know, skin of our teeth. And we got a decent venue, a sort of afternoon slot. And we didn't really suit that because we swear a lot. And we were a bit like Marmite, you know, that people got us or they didn't, you know, we were a bit older coming onto the comedy circuit. We'd sort of had our own little careers. I'd, you know, been musical theatre and my other mate Vix had done a bit of telly and stuff. And so we were going up there at sort of 30. She was 33 and I was 30. That was our first Edinburgh. And we felt a bit old and a bit uncool and we had our accents. And I remember one review said it was like a couple of Cockney birds having a fight outside a kebab shop. And I thought, great, we'll pop that on the post.
That's a fucking great review. Isn't it brilliant? I'd definitely go and see it.
Isn't it brilliant? Well, I can't remember who wrote that, but we love it. And thank you for that. Because, but yeah, it was difficult. And, you know, at the time when we tried to make it in the comedy world, it was very saturated, I found, with middle class and Oxbridge graduates, you know.
And do you still find that now when you're in the acting world? This is not a bait to posh bash at all.
No, of course not.
At all, but it's not about that. I'm just very interested about how sometimes, you know, from a working class point of view, how it makes you feel if you're, do you know, like if you're at the do's or at the awards?
Yeah, which is never.
I mean, there was a time for me that I felt, and I'm going back a fair few years, I would feel embarrassed.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel that I deserved to be at these places and these awards. So therefore, I would become more northern.
Yes.
to counteract anything else that may come in my way. So I would raise the shield of northernness straight away to go, even if you're not attacking me, just to say, this is here.
Yeah, I totally get that. And that really resonated with me when you said I felt like I didn't belong there, I shouldn't be there. I often feel like that a lot in life, really. Think, oh, fucking hell, you know, I shouldn't be here, you know. And I think that is just, and it's not because that's happening now. I think it's kind of, I mean, if there are people that are angry about class, I do get it. I think getting started is tricky, and that's a separate conversation about getting started as a working class, underprivileged sort of background. But in terms of like when you're in it, and I don't feel like that now. But then I'm in a position where I've had a really nice run at it the last few years, and I've had some really great jobs. But yeah. I met a team that I've met people along the way that understood me. But I think that's it anyway, right? Being understood as an actor or a comedian or a voice.
Or a human being.
As a human being, yeah.
I mean, you know, it comes up so often in life, you know, even when we're talking to friends, not even on the podcast, you know, if you find your tribe and you find the people who you click with, now whether that's your friends, your tribe of friends that you're with on a day-to-day life, or if you're upset, you can ring them, or if you're full of joy and you can share that information, or if you're in a, you know, in a working environment. It's about finding people who you click with, full stop, isn't it?
Oh, God. Yeah, absolutely. In every aspect of your life, in every corner of it. Talking about just feel like the class thing's prevalent now. No, but I think it has something to do with your casting. You know, like I don't really get seen for a posh bird, but why would I? Like when someone else is authentically, inherently that. Like there's nothing worse than hearing someone doing a Cockney accent, they can't do it, or they're, you know. But I don't think, I think there's some bits, you know, I think there's an element of... So, for example, if you're talking about a show like Mrs. Brown's Boys, and a lot of people have opinions on that show, right? Should I be talking about this, or we're going to...
We can talk about anything more.
So, for example, I watched this great clip of Kathy Burke when she won one of the comedy awards for Gimme, Gimme, Gimme.
I know exactly the clip you mean, and I love it, but please carry on.
It resonates with me, that clip, because she stands up, and Gimme, Gimme, Gimme at the time was panned by a lot of highbrow kind of reviewers and people saying it was broad, it was crass, it was this, it was that. But we cannot, it was undeniably, for me, funny. And I think, for me, that's my taste. And it appealed to the masses. Now, Mrs. Brown's Boys, for example, it's not for me, that show. However, my family love it, right? My mum, my dad, a lot of my aunties, my uncles. It gets millions and millions for their figures. And when they win awards, people turn their nose up and they have something to say about it. And I don't like that. I think it's uncool. And I think it's still something we're all working through. And I think, why have you got a comment on that? If you don't find it funny, that's up to you. But if something else highbrow won, I bet you wouldn't be slagging it off on Twitter. That's how I feel. I feel like there's a gun in for that show because it's broad, it's da-da-da, whatever. It might not be to your taste. I don't know. And that, to me, feels like there's a classist thing going on. There's that word. I've already made that up, but you know what I mean?
No, but I do know what you mean. And I think you're right. And also, there's something really simple that we can do, and it's dead easy. Switch over.
Yeah.
Don't watch it.
That is exactly what I say about anything. You know, I do comedy, and I do all different types of comedy. And I don't, if someone said to me it weren't for me, I'd never be insulted by that. And that's the thing, like when we were doing our shows in Edinburgh, I don't mind if you don't like this show. I don't mind if you don't think we're very funny. But don't slag off that we're not talented, or that we haven't got here, and we haven't spent time writing it, or that it doesn't appeal to somebody. And that's it, right? And I just think, I never get insulted by it. You know, oh, that show should never have won that award. How dare they? I just don't get like that. I just think, oh, good on them. Good on them.
The thing is, certainly with comedy, because, you know, anybody that knows me, even through this podcast, knows my love of comedy is what I grew up on. Comedy, it's there's such a broad aspect of comedy, and it shouldn't be for everybody. You should like certain things and different things, and everybody should have different tastes. We shouldn't all agree on everything, and that's fantastic.
Yeah.
But I had to take someone to task on social. Well, it wasn't on social media. I did it privately.
Yeah.
Because they were in a... I've got to be careful with my words here, Laura.
All right.
But they were in a position where they were reviewing or previewing television programmes. And they gave a scathing review of something that hadn't even been broadcast yet. And I thought it was punching down, and I thought it was really unfair and mean-spirited.
Yeah.
And I don't like that. And that's, look, if your job is of a reviewer, and once something has premiered and the public have had a chance to look at it and had a think about it, fine, you can say whatever you want. But prior to something coming out, it's just fucking mean.
It is, isn't it? And that, I mean, yeah, getting into a whole...
And, you know, it's like, well, you... Again, in a way, we're going back to the... It's a position of power.
Mm.
You've been given preview tapes of something here, so you're in a certain position. So you're a level of power. So for you to punch down that way is really unfair, because a lot of those people in this certain television programme put their heart and soul into it and worked really fucking hard to get there. And you're already preaching the word that you think is an absolute pile of shit.
It blows my mind, those reviews. You know, you get reviewers going, well, I hate musicals, well, why are you reviewing them then? Like, you know, don't send... We used to get, like, 18-year-old Oxbridge graduates come and review us, and it was like, as if he's going to find these two 30-year-old women who are from South London, very working class. He's never going to find us funny. We're fighting a losing battle. And I think that whole previewing thing is just... And then you just think, God, if you've got to enjoy your power so much by ruining someone's opportunity and it's not even come yet, I know that's your own shit. And it's, you know, it's just such poor form, isn't it? Like, I can't...
Yeah, I think it really is. I mean, but because what I did on this occasion, and the thing is, I don't have any other beef with this specific situation. And that's why I privately messaged this company to say, look, I really want you to take this with the grace that it's intended. I'm not telling you how to do your job by any means, but I think your tactics were slightly bullying and I don't think it's fair. But you take that however you want. I don't think it's on, really.
No.
I think it's mean and it's nasty and it's unfair in such a difficult industry. And anyway, they did message me back.
Oh, yeah.
And they said, Craig, thanks so much for your message. This is something that we need to look at. And we've taken down the posts.
Oh, okay.
And you're right. It ain't a cool thing to do.
That's great. And it's great that they listened and that they learned from that, because we're all allowed to do that, aren't we? We're allowed to evolve and learn. And
exactly. And we all make mistakes. And, yeah, we're allowed to make those mistakes and learn from it. But the thing is, I didn't go, you know, because we know sometimes that social media can be such a toxic place.
Yeah,
and, I mean, I found it a really positive place, I must admit. Very rarely have I bumped into... nastiness.
I've been lucky.
But if in high, you know, I could have just gone on the feed and just said this publicly,
hung him out,
but then again, what does that make me, Laura?
That's not cool either. I always think that. I think, you just not DM'd that person? I don't need to see your row on Twitter. Go away.
Because then also you're encouraging some sort of social media pile on.
Yeah.
We're just going back to school.
Yeah.
And we're not going to learn from that, because it's just going to, we're just going to feel very prickly and it's, we're just going to, you know, you're passing on the hurt.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. And when those things sort of come up, I have to quickly scroll by. It's not that I feel very uncomfortable with those sort of conversations on Twitter and public forums. It's just like, what's the point? You've got, like you said, if you're going to go on and do that, then you're wanting a fight. You're wanting everyone to bully this person back. And, you know, how do you like it now? It's like, oh God, it's really exhausting, isn't it? And I'm just a person, I've always been a peacekeeper. I've always, I check everything a million times before I send it over, because I'm always worried that, you know, I might come across like this or like that or whatever. And I do exactly the same with Twitter. Even if it's just a funny old tweet that no one's going to, you know, like two people might like, I still think, oh, make sure this thing, you know, sort of censoring myself all the time, because I never want to hurt. That's the big thing with me. I never want to hurt anyone's feelings. And I just don't know why other people don't have that in them.
Well, you know, it's a real shame, and it's sad that this is the world we live in, but, you know, we can just sort of, the best we can do is live by our morals, surely.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's, yeah, absolutely, I totally agree. It's that thing, isn't it, well, going, you know, you can't like that, that's wrong. It's like, that's just what, yeah, that's what I was talking about with the Mrs. Brown's Boys thing, like, you know, you can't like that, you're wrong, it's not funny. It says who? It's making her laugh, you know, it doesn't matter. Anyway.
Well, no, and I think you're completely right. And who are you to say what
exactly
makes me laugh?
Yeah.
Or the things that, you know, my mum and dad find funny.
Yeah.
Are not the things that I find funny, but that's okay.
Yeah.
That is okay.
Of course. It's just taste. It's nothing, isn't it? It's just so silly.
Well, it's nothing, but it's everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if we all had the same taste, then what a fucking boring world this would be.
100%, yeah.
Laura, I have loved our conversation.
So have I. I could literally go another couple of hours. Get me going now.
Well, here's the thing. What I'm going to definitely guarantee is that we do this again in person with lots of tea and lots of cake.
I would love that. I would absolutely love that. I'll have a coffee, though, if you don't mind, Craig.
Then I can sort that out. I don't drink coffee, but we can sort this out. Laura Checkley, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's honestly just been such a huge pleasure. What a lovely chat. Thank you, darling.
And another episode is done. What did I tell you? It's like sitting down and having a gabba with a dear old friend. So, Laura, if you're listening, I can't thank you enough for coming on and giving some of that free time that you've got right now. But listen, it's not even just about people giving their free time. It's when people come on, and obviously you know me and Laura haven't met before, but they come on and we have a conversation and they speak with such depth and warmth and honesty and eloquence. It really, really means the world, and that's what makes episodes like this kind of fizz. So I really hope you enjoyed it and you got something out of that. And if this is your first time, maybe the link to this, to Laura's episode, you want to go back and listen to Big Tom Davis, because he's been on, or the fantastic Rebecca Callard, she's also been on. Or maybe you want to scour through the rest of the back catalogue, because maybe you're not up to date. Maybe there's an episode there and you're thinking, but I don't know this person. I've never heard of them. I don't know what they do. I don't know what. Maybe have a listen. Dive in. Find out who they are. You might just be surprised. So look, I'm going to go now. I've got another day of homeschooling tomorrow. So look, thank you so much for downloading and subscribing, telling your friends, keep on doing that, supporting us on Patreon at such a difficult time. There's loads of people that are doing it, and honestly, myself and Griff cannot thank you enough. It really is keeping us going. And get in touch. You know we're on all the socials, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We're at twoshotpod@gmail.com. I can't believe it's our third year this year, I'm still forgetting the email. We love your emails. We love your messages, your photos. Get them all in. Keep in touch. Let's keep this listening community thriving, because that's what we do. We're all in this together. Right. I don't mean we're all in this together. What's going on? I mean, this podcast, we're all in this together. I'm not making reference to, yeah, you know what I'm saying. Okay. Look, until next week again, thank you so much for being there, downloading and subscribing. I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff, and this has been the Two Shot Podcast. Until next week, you take care, stay safe, and stay sound. See ya. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.